This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Andrew Jackson really was the first public figure who embodied both this extreme individualism and this extreme sense of democracy. He brought these two kind of seemingly contrary things together.
That's historian David Reynolds. We talked to him about Andrew Jackson's America in the first half of the show.
I take the bracing cold down with me from the fire tower at Mount Toby's summit. I take the quality of the light with me, its gold polish and September clarity.
And that's poet Wally Swist, reading from his latest collection, Mount Toby Poems. He'll grace us with more of them in the second half of the show. But first, Andrew Jackson's America. President Obama is just completing his second week in office as we produce this show. Obama ran on a populist platform of power coming from below, but he inherits an executive whose powers have been greatly swelled by 8 years under George W. Bush. Will Obama maintain, enhance, or scale back the powers of the executive? And what lessons about the balance of powers between the presidency and the Congress can he draw from previous occupants of the White House? The current president might find some clues in the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Like Obama, Jackson ran on a populist pro-democracy platform. But once in office, he redefined the presidency, making the executive branch more powerful than ever before. His opponents called him King Andrew. Yet he did this in a bid to trim back the power of the banks and what would become Wall Street, whose emergence was threatening America's democracy. Jackson presided over a country transitioning from a more egalitarian society based on the small, albeit white, yeoman farmer, to one dominated by the capitalist market, with its booms and busts and increasing concentrations of wealth. Historian David S. Reynolds has written several previous books about America in the 19th century. He talked to us here on Writer's Voice in 2006 about his wonderful biography of abolitionist John Brown. His latest book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson. Well, David Reynolds, welcome to Writer's Voice. Waking Giant, what a fun and wide-ranging book this was to read about Andrew Jackson's America. I mean, you cover revivals, snake oil, hucksterism, and other fads, prostitution and prudery, the birth of the two-party system. Over all of it is a picture of America in tremendous transition. And there's a great sense of energy about it all. Tell us first, what were some of the broad changes happening in American society as Andrew Jackson first came to office?
Well, I think the unshackling of democracy as a result of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the increasing recognition that social rights should be extended to all, even though at that time there was slavery and women were discriminated against. Still, there was an increasing awareness that these things should happen. And I think that this occurred during a time before the huge capitalist institutions of later on had settled in, and therefore there was this kind of unfettered spirit of experimentation that produced some of the greatest literature our country has ever seen in Poe and Hawthorne and Melville and Emerson and Walt Whitman, and some of the greatest art, which is the Hudson River School, and all kinds of sometimes wacky, sometimes very creative movements and fads and pseudosciences and religious cults and sects. So I think the word unfettered and unleashed kind of describe a lot of the period, and the fact that it was not yet hampered by a huge national government or by huge institutions or corporations.
And yet, those issues were beginning to be born. You spend the first part of your book, actually a fair amount of ink, on pre-Andrew Jackson, talking about James Monroe, talking about the National Bank and the struggle between the Federalists and states' writers?
Yeah, what happened before Andrew Jackson is that, you know, earlier on, there had been these Federalists who believed in a national bank and a strong national government and tariffs on the one hand, and those who believed in very weak government and, you know, extremely limited power for the presidency. And those ended up being the Democrats versus the Whigs. So Right after the War of 1812, which ended in 1815, there was an increasing sense of national pride and just a belief in America that produced under Monroe the Monroe Doctrine, which was the fact that European powers could not interfere in the Western Hemisphere, that America became the kind of policeman of the Western Hemisphere. At the same time, there was a compromise over slavery, drawing a line across the country above which slavery would not be allowed, below which it would be allowed. So an increasing sense of definition of what the country was, both on the world scene and internally.
So there was a kind of, the forces were definitely gathering. I mean, the Monroe Doctrine, we really think of manifest destiny. We think of nascent American imperialism. And changes in transportation also that really kind of kick-started American capitalism.
Yeah, the Erie Canal was completed in the mid-1820s, and what happens with that is that suddenly all the Western produce can be shipped over the Great Lakes and along the Erie Canal, then down the Hudson River through New York City, which becomes the financial capital of America at that time, and then it can be shipped abroad. So transatlantic trade is stimulated. At the same time, many, many other canals, as well as steamboat travel, begins to really kick in during this period. And in 1830 comes the first railroad train. Even though the railroad doesn't become a real national economic force until the 1850s, it still bodes well for the economic future. And so the gross national product begins to achieve a level of increase yearly that was maintained right up through most of the 20th century. So the whole machine of capitalism begins to kick in. At the same time, the first department stores are founded, and the first New York Stock Exchange comes in 1817. So there are little signs there of the capitalistic future. Even though the country still is mainly agricultural, the cities at the same time are growing.
Now, still with Monroe, because I think you lay it out that what was going on in his time really helped to give rise to Andrew Jackson and his candidacy and his win of the presidency. You say it signaled the problems, social problems, during Monroe's administration signaled profound contradictions in the nation's identity. Are you talking about this contradiction between the yeoman farmer and the birth of the market?
Yeah, basically, because what happened is that the National Bank was recharted just before Monroe took office. So you had this, on the one hand, a kind of capitalist mentality that would mark the future, but at the time, no one knew that was necessarily the destiny of America, which was straining very much against this vision that Thomas Jefferson had of the yeoman farmer, a nation of independent yeoman farmers. And that was still a moment when that agricultural vision had not died. So the idea of the self-sufficient nation, this nation of self-sufficient farmers, clashed with the more impersonal notion of going out in the capitalist marketplace and a belief in central capitalistic institutions.
We'll spell that out for us a little bit. Tell us, what does a national bank do? Why did it represent this one side? Why was it opposed? And how was it connected, or was it connected, to this whole tariff issue? What was that all about?
Well, the Whig Party, it wasn't called the Whigs at that time until the 1830s, but people like Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, believed in a central institution, the National Bank, that would hold public monies. The problem for its opponents was that, like Andrew Jackson, who emerged really largely over the bank issue, his view was that, first of all, the bank was under the rule of Nicholas Biddle, this kind of capitalistic type, and a large portion of its stockholders were actually British. So the idea of British stockholders owning large shares of this National Bank of America, to some patriot like Andrew Jackson, who had defeated the British during the War of 1812, this was anathema. And also Jackson really wanted to place federal monies in smaller banks around the nation. It was his vision of a more democratic system, and he thought this concentration of wealth. Today, of course, we're very accustomed to concentrations of wealth. At that time, this was very, very new. It seemed to speak of rising class divisions between the rich and the poor, and with the high-flying capitalists kind of hoarding all the money and so forth, and some of these rich executives in the bank getting wealthy by not really working hard, but just kind of trading their stock and so forth. So Jackson transforms the bank into this kind of monster of upper-class corruption, and he attacks the bank, and he slays it, actually. In the 1830s, he comes along and prevents its recharter, and he starts his system of so-called pet banks. There were 93 of these smaller banks around the country in which federal funds were deposited. A controversial scheme, but at this time, to him and his supporters, it seemed democratic.
Well, from the standpoint of the crash of 2008 in the banking system, maybe he sounds like he was a little bit prescient.
Yeah, I mean, today we have tremendous concentrations of wealth as well as they began to have in that time. Also, a kind of sense of over-speculation and over-borrowing and over-lending on the part of the central bank that then led to, this kind of deficit spending and also this massive credit. This was during the early 1830s, just prior to the panic of 1837. And then what happens in 1837 is that the banks call in their loans, and there's a whole tightening of money, and there's a run on the banks. So 40% of the banks at that time collapsed. And then for 5 years, there was pretty much of a depression with hundreds of thousands of people out of work and great unemployment and great business failure. That was between 1837 and 1842, largely as a result of the bank collapse.
Reverse deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
We're talking with David S. Reynolds, historian David Reynolds, about his book, Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson. Okay, so Andrew Jackson gets in. When was he first elected?
1828.
And he comes in. First, give us a little bit of the flavor of the man as a personality.
Well, Jackson was a thin man with sort of a gaunt face and hair that formed a V on his forehead, and he had a very earnest expression. He had a personality that was both explosive and yet, in a way, charming. I mean, he could be a very charming man. He had a good sense of humor. He was unlettered. It was rumored that he had only read one book other than the Bible all the way through, and that was a novel called The Vicar of Wakefield. So unlike his opponent, John Quincy Adams, who knew seven languages and who was a scholar of Chinese history and Russian history and everything, Jackson, who was from a log cabin in Tennessee, was relatively unlearned. But he was a shrewd man, though, and he had a good way with language, surprisingly good, and he could communicate very, very well. And he really won the hearts of the people. He was the first people's president in a big, big way, huge way, in a way that John Quincy Adams, who confessedly, by his own confession, was a rather cold, reserved man, was not.
And how did he win the hearts of the people? How did he campaign?
He was the first president who really made personal appearances. Not that they campaigned in that day in the organized fashion that they do now, but he was the first one really to go out and meet the people, make personal appearances. There were huge rallies on his behalf. He was known as Old Hickory, and so hickory sticks and hickory brooms proliferated, and campaign songs. There was also a fair amount of dirty tricks campaigning going on. His supporters presented John Quincy Adams as a kind of a pimp, or they didn't use that word, but someone who had traded the sexual favors of a beautiful secretary to the Tsar of Russia when he was a diplomat in Russia. Meanwhile, Adams' followers charged that Jackson had been the son of the union of a mulatto man and a prostitute, a common prostitute, and that Jackson's brother had been sold into slavery. So there was a lot of dirty tricks. These were all erroneous accusations. But in spite of everything, Jackson just remained very, very popular. His wife, Rachel, was wounded psychologically during the campaign because one of the dirty stories was that they had lived together before they were married. What had actually happened is that she thought she had a divorce from her previous husband, but she didn't realize the divorce papers hadn't been finalized. So she did live with Andrew Jackson. They did have a marriage ceremony, but she never escaped insults about the so-called adultery, and some people say she was driven to her death by all the mud that was slung at Andrew Jackson over this incident.
And that really was a terrible wound for him as well. He was very much in love with her.
Yeah, he always loved her. He never remarried. He loved her retrospectively. He wore a black, what was called a weeper, a ribbon in his hat on her behalf, and he usually dressed in black just in her memory. So he loved her very much.
Now, he was kind of a mass of contradictions himself. I mean, he a loving husband, but a pretty pugnacious guy. He went around for much of his life with a lead ball lodged near his heart that was the result of a duel. Talk about his pugnaciousness.
Well, he followed the Southern Code of Honor. At that time, if you lived in the South and if you were a gentleman and if somebody insulted you, you would either go on a shooting spree or else, you know, as a kind of family feud, or more commonly, you would challenge your opponent to a duel. So he was engaged in three duels, one of which he was shot by his opponent in the chest, and the bullet lodged within 1 inch of his heart. He had that bullet in his body for the rest of his life. It caused great abscesses and coughing up green slime and all of this stuff, but he was actually proud of that duel because his opponent was the best marksman in the state, and Jackson raised his gun and fired and killed the guy, shot him in the bowels. But
shot him in the balls?
No, not the balls, the bowels.
Oh, shot him in the... okay.
Bowels, yeah. And then he also had a bullet in his shoulder from a street gun brawl. Again, this was fairly common for a Southern... It was a violent culture in many respects, and he was kind of following the rule down there, so to speak, at that time. Also, the first assassination attempt occurred during his presidency, and someone came out from behind a pillar at the Capitol building and stood within 8 feet of him and shot, and the gun fired, but the bullet didn't come out. They had primitive revolvers, and the bullet didn't come out. So instead of doing what most of us would do, that is to say, duck out of the way, Jackson charged his assailant with a cane. He was 66 years old at the time, and he just lifted his cane and just went. Then the guy drew out another gun and again fired. It exploded, but the bullet didn't come out again. So Jackson should have been killed, but he said, "I was not born to be assassinated." He said he never felt the emotion of fear once in his life, ever.
Old Hickory.
Old Hickory, right.
Great. Now, you say he created the two-party system.
Yeah, inadvertently, really, because he stood for certain principles against entrenched capitalist institutions that were increasingly coming on the scene, against the Bank of the United States. But also, he used the veto power so often, he used it more than all the other presidents put together at that time, previous to him, that he himself was considered to be King Andrew, this kind of despot, by certain opponents like Webster, like Clay, and like Calhoun. And so they formed the second party, which was the Whig Party at that time. And later it was the Whigs versus the Democrats, which later became the Republicans versus the Democrats.
As you say, he was portrayed as King Andrew. He greatly increased the power of the executive.
Yeah.
But he was also a Democrat. So reconcile these two sides of him, these two aspects.
Yeah, well, what happened, it's the poet Walt Whitman, who idolized Andrew Jackson, came along later on and said, the great paradox of America is, on the one hand, it allows for individual expression more than any other country. At the same time, it believes in democracy and leveling more than any other country, and a belief in I'm no better than you are, you're no better than I am, and so forth. So Andrew Jackson really was the first public figure who embodied both this extreme individualism and this extreme sense of democracy. he brought these two kind of seemingly contrary things together. He's very self-assertive and very individualistic, but at the same time, he stood for the everyman. And the common people just adored him. They loved him. They wanted to reach out to him and touch him whenever, wherever he was.
And increasing the power of the executive, is that something that you think has, I mean, is that a legacy that has remained then that we can trace back to Jackson? Or do you feel, you know, that that power has just ebbed and flowed?
I think we can trace it back to Jackson because the presidents before him, Monroe and particularly Adams, Adams was rather a weak president in terms of the power that he exercised. He was frozen by Congress, a Congress who opposed his every move, and he didn't have the kind of personal magnetism to transcend that. Jackson came along, and he adjusted the balance of powers so that the three branches of the government began to be a little more equalized. Previously, it was the congressional and, to some degree, the judicial that had the most power, and now he threw in the executive branch as being also very, very powerful. And since that day, of course, all the way through Bush, we've had this kind of, some people would say, an almost imbalance of power on behalf of the executive branch, but still a much stronger executive branch than previously.
And one of the ways in which he exercised his power was to really push through, I mean, you can only call it ethnic cleansing, of the Indian tribes, the Seminoles, the Chickasaws, the
Cherokees.
The Cherokees. And he had a background in the Indian Wars. Talk about Andrew Jackson and his impact on Native Americans.
Well, in Waking Giant, I show that I try to contradict those who simply dismiss him as a murderer, as an ethnic cleanser. I think it certainly was a tragedy what happened, but it was an almost inevitable one because so many of the tribes had vast amounts of land, Indian tribes, and all the presidents from Jefferson onward said that something had to be done about this, and most of them, Jefferson himself had said that these tribes will have to be pushed beyond the Stony Mountains, now known as the Rocky Mountains.
Beyond the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah, yes, actually beyond them.
And why couldn't we live peacefully with the Indians?
The idea was that a lot of them would not integrate into American society, and yet they occupied huge, hundreds of thousands of acres of land, particularly throughout the South and the Northwest. And they were claiming governmental independence from the United States. So also there were huge wars going on between the whites who kept expanding and then trying to conquer portions of the Indian lands. And actually Jackson sympathized with the Indians because he said most of these wars are being created by the whites who just want to strip the Indians of their land. So he thought that he was doing the Indians a favor by transporting them westward with government money and giving them reservations in what is now Oklahoma and getting them out of harm's way so that they could kind of settle down and be peaceful. Unfortunately, what happened is that he did resettle them, but he did so through treaties, that many of which were kind of frauds. They weren't truly approved by the entire Indian tribes with which they were made. And so there's a certain amount of trickery, fraudulence, and also a certain amount of cruelty. There are websites devoted to comparing Jackson to Hitler and the Jews, but it's not quite like that. They did put them in camps sometimes, but these were not death camps. They weren't very nice to be in, but still, they were not put to death there. They were hoarded in there and crowded in there, so they would be then sent west over what was known as the Trail of Tears.
And didn't quite a few Native Americans die?
Yeah, about a total of 63,000 died of disease and starvation and so forth. So yeah, it was a pretty grim situation. There wasn't really organized slaughter of the Native Americans, but yeah, a lot of them died along the way.
And I'm speaking with historian David S. Reynolds about his book, Waking Giant. It's about America during the Age of Jackson. Now, what about the slavery issue? Of course, that was a huge issue at the time. You say that Jackson tried to kind of steer a middle course. A middle course between what?
Between the extreme Southerners who defended slavery to the extent where they wanted to secede from the nation and form their own country, and the extreme Northerners, the abolitionists, who hated slavery so much that they, too, advocated disunion or separation of the North and the South. Some of the extreme abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, believed that the South should just separate and go its own way, and then eventually slavery would rot off the vine down there. So Jackson wanted to hold the Union together. In this way, he anticipated Abe Lincoln, who was also a strong pro-Union man. So Jackson wanted to strike some kind of compromise that would hold the Union together.
Tell us a little bit about the voting system. I was surprised to find out in your book that free blacks and women did actually lose the vote.
Yeah, there was actually a regression during this period. That early on, before this period, there had been certain states that had permitted the African-American vote and even the women's vote, but they actually lost ground during this period. There was kind of a rising racism. Racism had always been in America, but there was kind of a rising sense of it with pseudoscience that seemed to suggest that Africans were of a lower species and so forth. So there was actually an increase of the kind of racism that would later, unfortunately, flower during the Jim Crow segregation period later on. And also there was a kind of rising of certain gender roles whereby women were supposed to keep out of politics and keep quiet about public issues and just stay in the home and take care of the home. So these kind of two aspects of racism and then gender division fed right back into politics and restricted both of those groups at that time.
Maybe that shows that we have to always defend them.
Yeah.
You know, what parallels, if any, do you see during Jackson's administration, Jackson's time, and our own? I'm asking you because, you know, if Jackson could somehow give some advice through the Ouija board to President Obama today, what do you think he might give?
Well, first of all, I think that Obama, so far at least, has done a pretty good job of keeping alive the Jacksonian spirit. By that, he's dealing with a completely different kind of America with different forms of communication and so forth. But still, the Jacksonian spirit is trying to at least give the image of reaching out to the people, to average Americans. And with these tremendous rallies that Obama has had, with this reaching out through the internet in kind of a vast way, particularly to younger and to working class Americans, and even his call for transparency in government, not necessarily a limited government in the Jacksonian sense, but a kind of a sense of openness and transparency, I think that Obama is keeping alive the spirit of Andrew Jackson, this kind of populist spirit. I suppose one could question some of his cabinet choices, some of which kind of reach back to kind of establishmentarian, Democrats from the Clinton years. I will say that Jackson himself made the error during his first term of choosing establishment figures that were kind of close friends of his. His first cabinet eventually resigned over a scandal. His second cabinet was actually, a much better cabinet. But, some people might charge both Jackson and Obama with, not necessarily making always the best cabinet choices. But on the other hand, I think the general spirit of the Obama, both the campaign and the presidency so far, have been very much in the Jacksonian mold of trying to make the government transparent and open to the people, so to speak. Today, we can never be as open as we used to be because back then you could actually make an appointment with the president if you were an average citizen and go in and see the president on a one-to-one basis. So we live in a different kind of America where presidents appear in sound bites on TV, but very rarely do people get a chance to actually go into his office and shake his hand and talk with him. But still, given the limitations that we have, Obama's doing a pretty good job, I think, in being a kind of neo-Jacksonian.
Well, David S. Reynolds, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book is Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson.
Thank you for having me.
David S. Reynolds won the Bancroft Prize for his book, Walt Whitman's America. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from his latest, Waking Giant. Coming up, we talk with poet Wally Swist about his new collection, Mount Toby Poems. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts is lucky to count poet Wally Swist as one of its residents. That's because our region gets to be the subject of so many of his fine poems about nature. Long known as one of America's finest practitioners of the Japanese poetry form haiku, in recent years Swist has moved to longer form verse. It allows him to explore his unique sensibility about place and our place as human beings in it. His forthcoming poetry collection is Mount Toby Poems, to be published in February 2009 by Timberline Press. Why don't you tell us, first of all, a little bit about Mount Toby for those of our listeners who aren't from the Western Massachusetts area here?
Sure. Mount Toby is located in Sunderland, Massachusetts, and it's not a tall mountain, although it's the highest point, I believe, in the Pioneer Valley at 1,260 feet.
And it's a very unusual kind of a construction, isn't it?
Well, it's more like a mesa, actually. There's a lovely fire tower, which is actually it's actually used by fire lookout people during the warmer season. But the view from the fire tower is actually there's a poem entitled "Taking It Back with Me" that I actually describe the view at 1 o'clock. You can on a clear day you can see Mount Monadnock. At 11 o'clock, you can see Mount Snow clearly. And on a clear day, you can see Mount Greylock due west.
And these are all the higher peaks in
all
our area.
All the higher peaks.
Well, why don't you read that poem? That would be the best way for us to find out about Mount Toby.
I take the bracing cold down with me from the fire tower at Mount Toby's summit. I take the quality of the light with me, its gold polish and September clarity, the flash of those steel girders, the breath of the view, Monadnock's granite dome, just a touch north-northeast, Greylock's prominence due west, Snow's jagged peak at 11 o'clock. I take the sound of the wind with me, the invisible surf spreading through treetops across this valley. I stand on the wooden platform of the top tier, my hands holding onto a bend in the metal guardrail, the Connecticut River flowing below, swollen after days of rain, and before taking it back with me, I watch that one red oak leaf above the tree line, suspended and spinning in the cross drafts.
Well, that's a lovely poem, and I love the idea of the cold and the wind as you put them together, that kind of wave of cold and the wave of the wind. So you have some other poems from this same volume of poetry, Mount Toby Poems, is
yes,
that correct?
As a matter of fact, I do. This is entitled Walking Stick, and it's prefaced with a quote from Emily Dickinson, which I absolutely love. I was reading Alfred Habiger's book, My Wars Are Laid Away in Books, which is a terrific biography on Dickinson. And when I came across this quote, to borrow Dickinson's phrase regarding poetry, took off the top of my head. Take all away from me, but leave me ecstasy. Walking stick. If you make a gift of your walking stick, make it a thick pine branch, stripped of the bark, the one that has accompanied you on many hikes, let it be the one that has secured your steps on Toby, Grace, and Lafayette. Brush the wood with layers of polyurethane. Cincture the top with a sash of wound leather strips tied in a bow knot. Then insert hawk feathers to billow above the woven cords, and prana it to guide her on a trail in the wild. By your making it a gift, bless her as she walks wherever she walks, so that she may remember she is one with everything, that she is safe whenever she walks. It is imperfectly fashioned, unlike your ecstasy, but it is designed to remind her of that.
Well, tell us about this person who is the recipient of this wonderful gift. Is this a gift that you yourself made?
Yes, as a matter of fact, a number of my poems are actual work poems. It seems that through the process of either stacking wood or making a walking stick, those acts develop into poems. The recipient of this gift is a person with whom I have a special friendship with still, and quite a spiritual, the person is quite advanced spiritually, she's quite a touchstone.
Touchstone is a lovely word in itself. Can you say, what does it really mean to you? What is a touchstone?
Oh, a touchstone. A touchstone is, a touchstone could either be a person or even a place. I know that I have power spots such as Toby or other spots in the valley or in New England for that matter that could be termed touchstones. There are certain people that remain touchstones in our lives. One is replenished by these individuals. I don't think we ever have a lot of them. I don't think that there are a lot of people that can be that special, that is perhaps Carolyn Mace, the medical intuitive, may say that people come into our lives to enter our lives, and we need and to access certain attributes that we have. So there's, when we're speaking about an individual who is a touchstone, it's someone whom we have a replenishment with.
And we're talking with Wally Swist about his forthcoming collection, Mount Toby Poems. What would you like to read us next?
Well, you know, since we spoke about walking stick and the recipient of that gift, I'd like to read a brand new poem. I think it's interesting. Poets, especially more than fiction writers, we have a tendency of wanting to read a new piece or our newest piece. 10 years ago, when I was at Trinity College in Hartford, I had the honor of hosting Billy Collins.
The great poet who was Poet Laureate of the United States.
Yes, most certainly. And I also introduced him as a preeminent American humorist, which he also is. But in any case, Billy started the reading off with four or five new poems. Not all of them I liked, for that matter. This is entitled Cinnamon Sticks, and it segues with what I was attempting to describe as sharing light with this one individual. Cinnamon Sticks. You asked me years ago, tell me how you know when to use them. I do not remember what I answered you then, but it is in their aromatic sweetness and their pungence that can achieve piquancy in a dish. It can be in a simple curry or in a bolognese. Stir the cinnamon sticks in with extra virgin olive oil in a pan over the flame, several dashes of coriander, cumin, garam masala, a whole bulb of crushed garlic, diced sweet Mayan onion, chopped Holland and green bell peppers. Then add crushed tomatoes, tomato paste, a pound of uncooked ground beef. The sliced zucchini goes in last. And love, yes, an ingredient of love. Over low heat for an hour, although it is the last component in the concoction that neither one of us will ever forget. Seeing you standing at the crosswalk the other day, as I did just happen to drive past when we both waved and smiled, made me think of your asking me about cinnamon sticks and how I can finally offer you an answer specific enough. in that I use them the same way I would massage those knots loose in the muscles of your back, then place kisses on each of your bare shoulders. It occurred to me that I use cinnamon sticks that way. Although I did think about another question you would ask me, which was, I want to know what those lights are when I look at you. What are those lights and where do they come from? After all these years of our being separate from one another, but together being able to enter ever further into the light of what is beatific that shines from each of our faces, it appears through this radiance we have become aware of that question having answered itself.
What a lovely poem. I mean, it started out almost like a work poem that you referred to before, the poem of Chopping Wood, which you've read on this show before, and the one of the walking stick, but then it segues into a beautiful love poem.
Thank you. Why don't I read another poem from Mount Toby? And actually, why don't we segue that into, there's a suite of poems that I composed largely in the autumn, and I've always been quite fond of Pablo Neruda's, all of Neruda's work, especially his odes, but one of the first books of poetry, well, one of the many books of poetry I fell in love with in my late teens, for sure, was 20 Love Poems and a Song of Despair. So the cycle of 20 poems is modeled after Neruda's book. He actually wrote that book when he was 19 and published it. It was his second book of poems. Let me read a poem which actually is forthcoming in Ruminate, a magazine of faith in literature and art out of Fort Collins, Colorado. It's entitled Queen Anne's Lace. Every summer, a specific species of wildflower has its season, grows in abandon, to spread across the landscape, fills the meadows from Mount Pollux to the highway's median strip, basks in the cracks of broken pavement buckling along Farmington Avenue in the restaurant district of Hartford's West End and West Hartford's borderline. When you cut down two stems of Queen Anne's lace at Crepalo in the Berkshire Hills to exhibit elegance and strength in nature, you are drawn to the parasol that leans into the coolness of evening, that nods in the rain, that remains open beneath the sun and the moon. A whole field of it is a tapestry of flat white tops that italicizes the contrast of green meadow grass, sustained whimsy, silent applause. Walking the rise at dusk after thunderstorms in our crocs, we slosh through bedstraw, bladder campion, and fleabane. One of my hands riding on one of your shoulders, to look south across the Holyoke Range, then north toward Pocumptuck and Toby, to watch the spirals of mist clear the sides of the ridges below early stars. We do not want to let any of this go. What can only be spoken through the actions of our loving, the word made flesh, and our flesh spoken word, wind blown wild carrot that roots in earth and whose stalks rock in our summering.
And we should tell our listeners, you're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet Wally Swist. You know, as you're reading, it occurred to me that the kind of poetry that you write here is almost like a photograph. It's a moment in time. And I'd like to ask you, when you're writing these, do they just kind of flow out with inspiration, or are you working and reworking a poem?
an old acquaintance of mine who's a painter once said to me that artists' growth are measured in decades and not years. The poems recently have come out in white heat. This suite or cycle certainly did for the most part. However, as much as I attempt to learn from each poem and each revision, I guess I'd have to say that I still go through a couple of dozen drafts. On occasion, I also would have to say that there's some poems that go through 60 or 70 drafts. And also to address that is that most recently, since I'm working in a longer line, when I was invested and dedicated, I also wrote longer poems as well as haiku, but when I was working in the haiku genre, when in about 12 or 14 years, I wrote some 5,000 to 6,000 haiku and published over 900, I was working in a shorter line. But after working with an editor, Parkman Howe, who is the poetry editor at Appalachia, which is the mouthpiece of the Appalachian Mountain Club. It's a lovely journal, and I must admit that I love appearing in there for a number of reasons. Most saliently is that almost every issue that I find myself in, Mary Oliver has a poem, and that's always extremely fine company because I'm so fond of Mary's work. So I just recently recast, this is the third time in about 10 or 12 years that I've recast my entire oeuvre into a longer line. Linda Gregg once spoke to me regarding this with respect to enjambment on a line where you end a sentence and begin another sentence. I am very fond of crafting the syntax so that if you read that line backwards, it's also a complete sentence, or it also inflects the gives the poem another inflection, another facet.
Could you give an example of that?
I can actually. Let's go to Queen Anne's Lace. There's a line that reads "Early stars." Period. And then the enjambment is, we do not want to let any of this go. Now, if you read that backwards, we do not want to let any of this go, early stars. So there's that inflection there that I like to, I want to say it's not spending time on the poem in a foolish way. It's not making the poem perhaps too tight. I think it actually opens the poem to various possibilities and other readings upon rereadings, which is when I believe one has crafted a well-made poem, then it really ascribes to itself several readings and many readings over the course of time. Would you like to hear another poem?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
And also, before you read the poem, tell us a little bit about the poem, what inspired it.
Oh, Queen Anne's Lace or the next piece?
Both of them, actually, Queen Anne's Lace and then the next one.
Queen Anne's Lace is a I've developed my own phrase of what my work is all about. It's truly, and this certainly was the case in the haiku when I was working in the haiku genre for so many years, but it's finding the epiphany in the commonplace, and Queen Anne's Lace is an epiphanal poem. It's spreads out the moment. Is a moment that is not just recorded in time, but has a sense of its own perpetuity, its own eternity in the finite moment. There's a lovely tension in that. I feel that our lives are one eternal moment after another in a finite lifetime. So Queen Anne's Lace is certainly an epiphanal poem. This next piece is entitled Leaving. And it's not a reminiscence, but it's a recorded memory of seeing something or feeling something or intuiting, much more so something about to end, and actually having a sign or a number of signs. And let me read it. Leaving. When I look out across the pasture at Larch Hill this Saturday in mid-October, I think of how often we would walk here together and talk to the herd of cows that would interrupt their grazing and come to meet us by the electrified wire fence, huddled in their collective affection, tails swatting away flies. And how we didn't quite want to leave that last time in early September, but remained to stay before going, to warm ourselves in the sun, and how I indicated to you that farther up the cinder path to the right is where I would release prayers by the white pasture gate to ask for guidance from Jesus. I have looked out across the farmyard garden beyond and over. The weeks have observed that single maple tree that overlooks the ridges of the Holyoke Range turn from green to crimson, then lose all of its leaves. Learn not to look for answers, is what I have heard. And when I have been able to listen, there is nothing that offers more grace than loving deeply. Upon our going, we passed a woman who was sitting on the wooden bench on the boardwalk, and when we walked by her, I remarked to you, having been startled by the look on her face, that apparently she must be struck with grief. But I believe the woman was not an ordinary woman, but an angel that appeared before us and for what is the rest of our lives watched with such sadness in those eyes, our leaving paradise.
Of course, there are many ways in which one can think about leaving in that poem. You're leaving a certain area where you've been walking. There's the sense of the leaving of a life, and also the implication of a leaving of a relationship. Is that true?
Yes, leaving on a number of levels or layers.
And yet the love is still part of that leaving?
There's a wonderful line in a poem by Jack Gilbert, which is the title poem, The Great Fires. Love lasts by not lasting. I believe that for most of us in our lives, that's the truth. It's a mystical truth, in the sense that love augments itself in a relationship, especially a long-term relationship. However, love often does not last. Jack said to me once, he was being jocular or jovial, I think it's actually in a poem of his, but that love has a half-life of 2.5 years. Love lasts by not lasting. This particular person who had entered my life last year had contacted me. I had completely forgotten about her. She actually phoned me because she saw my name on a poster for a reading I was giving. And in any case, I had asked her to dance in seventh grade. So that was decades ago. In any case, she was my first crush, and she certainly will always be a great love, but it didn't last. I'd like to read a poem that is a poem of reconciliation. Of course, in some cases, that's not a possibility, but the poem is a kind of a prayer as well. Leonard Cohen has a poem entitled Gift, in which he has an image in the poem where in making a gift of silence to the recipient of the gift, she would hand the silence back to him as if it were another poem. I've always been attracted to that piece. However, I think I go beyond Cohen in the piece, in my own poem. Gift. If I offer you a gift of a glass chrysanthemum goblet filled with flat crystal sea glass shape gemstones, it is to charm the child within you. And if I make a gift to you of rainbowed glass, within clear glass placed beneath a kiln-fired, glazed celadon clay bowl, it is to respect all of what we have held together and that we carry always. If I offer you reconciliation in the shining of glass and the luster of clay, it is not just for us to become aware of what holds its buff and polish, but to see the best in each other, through which we may be able to open in forgiveness of one another and begin to recognize ourselves and our shadows.
Well, Wally Swiss, thanks so much for coming here and reading your beautiful poems, not just reading beautiful poems, but reading your poems beautifully.
Oh, Francesca, it's always an absolute pleasure.
Swiss is the recipient of the Haiku Society of America Merit Book Award and two Museum of Haiku Literature Awards. The Poets of New England documentary film series has come out with a film In Praise of the Earth, the poetry of Wally Swiss. There'll be a screening of the film In Praise of the Earth at the Hitchcock Center for the Environment in Amherst, Thursday, February 5th at 7 p.m. The poet will be there to answer questions from the audience. And Swiss will give a reading, along with poet Susan Gage Tyler, at Green Street Cafe in Northampton on Thursday, February 12th at 9 p.m. For more information about the poet and other readings he's giving, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.